all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
Hello again, listeners. Welcome back to Greenhouse Gaslighting, the show where we reject conventional wisdom for common sense. Or will we? I'm glad to resume the discussion from our first episode, and I'm going to properly reintroduce our guest this time. She is an MPA candidate that works with nonprofits and advocacy groups and has very principled anime opinions. Please welcome Gabby.
Ooh!
Hi!
He is a self-described Daedric Lord of Centrism and a law student and an actual MPA. Please say hi to Zach again, everyone.
Ooh! I'm such Hello, a big everybody. Fan!
Thank you.
And he is another MPA. Wow, all the guests are MPAs today. That works in local government and currently serves as a precinct delegate in the Michigan Democratic Party. Say hi to Tyler, everyone.
Hello. It is a pleasure. I don't know if I'll be able to follow up Ryan last week and his various comments on eating ass, but I will do my best.
Be yourself, man. That's my only rule here. So coming off of last week's discussion, the major updates have followed with folks snitching on Twitter. Amazon, Google, and others have pulled their web hosting services for the app Parler, which became a cornerstone of last week's discussion. And there are bulletin boards along the freeway asking you to snitch to the FBI. Aside from that, yeah. I'm kind of the mind that this has been a very boring time in quarantine. You know, save for the Capitol stuff, it's actually been very quiet, and I'm not sure what to think.
Well, don't jinx it now, man. Today's supposed to be the next day it kicks off.
So, I do want to touch back up on, you know, with the president getting banned on Twitter. That was the other big thing, right?
Yep.
Our Twitter president, now off Twitter, several days before the next president is about to be inaugurated. And does anyone have any thoughts, free speech-wise, or, you know, what was your read of that, of what happened?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that the president violated Twitter's community guidelines and standards. So there's a couple of important considerations. Normally, my first thought would be, wow, it's frightening that Twitter can effectively silence a, you know, like one of the world leaders. That said, if that world leader is inspiring insurrection, denying reality, promoting blatantly false conspiracy theories that target the core of our democracy, whether that's rooted in something malicious or just plain narcissism, I don't know if that's relevant. But, you know, if that's the line, I think that's okay. But Twitter should enforce that across the world, and it should enforce that line not just on President Trump, but think of other world leaders who blatantly do that. Blatant autocracy and oppression of people.
Well, okay, so Brazil and India, right, straight off of Twitter then, huh?
I mean, yeah.
Well, different autocrats who do certain things like that. I mean, I don't want to accuse world leaders right now, but because I don't have any, I don't follow their Twitter feeds, but I'd imagine, you know, for instance, if North Korea's, you know, Kim Jong-un was on Twitter, that wouldn't be someone we would want on the platform. So that's an important consideration. I've heard people who support President Trump raise that criticism, like, oh, you're gonna ban President Trump, but you're not gonna ban, you know, Xi Jinping, you know, for instance. Like, why would Twitter be okay with that? And I've also seen, and maybe someone could verify this for me if I'm incorrect, but Ron Paul has been banned, I think, for criticizing the policy of banning President Trump. And I don't think expressing your opinion should be the cause of somebody who's otherwise been, you know, someone you might disagree with. Ron Paul's a former presidential candidate with very strong libertarian beliefs, but he maybe didn't deserve to be banned for however many hours or days it was. I think it was 12 hours. So those are my thoughts on that. And I think that while it was probably right to do it, to ban President Trump's, you know, posting that was doing a bunch of bad, was denying mm-hmm. reality, inciting insurrection, all that stuff, right? If that's the line, I think Twitter should enforce it. And I don't think Twitter should be very liberal with banning dissenting opinions otherwise, now, if they're not harmful.
I'm a little ignorant on this. What happened to Rand Paul? He was suspended on Twitter because he was criticizing Twitter for suspending Trump. Nope. Is that what it was?
Nope. Not Rand Paul. Ron Paul, his father.
Sorry, Ron Paul. My bad.
Yeah, Ron Paul. And as far as I know, Ron Paul was simply speaking out against Twitter's action against President Trump, banning President Trump, and then was banned for 12 hours, I think. I actually don't know at the time.
See, I think it's a good point there, because I think the line that very clearly needs to be drawn, and so far I think Twitter has done a decent job of drawing that line, is when someone is actively advocating the overturn of a free and fair election, and when somebody's actively advocating violence to make that happen, I think that is a very clear, very easy to draw line, like take this person off our platform, you know, suspend, remove, what have you. But the idea of banning someone because they don't like that idea, I might want to know a little bit more specifically of what exactly Paul Sr. said. But yeah, if it was literally he was just criticizing that ban and then he was removed, I don't think that's necessarily good. And here's where we hit the thing, right? These are ultimately private platforms that are completely controlling public discourse, right? And there's no way that the public gets to kind of review or have input on these processes of who exactly gets removed and for what reasons they get removed. We all just kind of get forced to agree, right, when we sign up for the platforms.
Yeah, I mean, I never read the terms of service. Let's
exactly. I mean, if anybody here says they have, then I'm going to accuse them of being a liar. I guess Zach might have. He seems like the type. But yeah, it's just, I know you guys touched on last week how when it comes to a private platform having such control over public discourse, I mean, that's ultimately the crux of the issue, right? Like, who gets to control for what reasons they're being banned? We can all agree on certain things, like advocating violence, but criticizing bans isn't necessarily a reason to get banned, right?
Well, I think, what you're saying, kind of this topic about public discourse being on private spaces, when Zach was talking about the way Trump was banned for what he was saying, and this kind of people talking about this being an infringement on free speech, and then also the kind of radio silence, I guess, we've heard from him in comparison to the last 4 years. Like, I think we all had gotten really used to hearing a constant bombardment of his thoughts because he was constantly putting them on Twitter. And now it feels very silent because he's saying comparatively less. But it means he has to take advantage of those official communications instead of the unofficial, like Twitter communications, which in my opinion is something I think presidents should be primarily communicating through. I don't think we should be getting vital information about our president via social media. Just that's a personal preference. Yeah. Especially I think back to like earlier in his presidency, and what I wonder, so Twitter just now decided to ban him, right? But like he was instigating with North Korea.
Just tweeting about the attack on Iran that happened last year. So, and that's why I touched on last week, and I'm just going to bring it up again. Why now? Why now to ban Trump?
Like, yeah, that's
especially
exactly,
like
yeah.
when it's 2 weeks and he's out on the job.
Like it feels, and this might be pessimistic, but it feels like Twitter is just trying to win a few points to be like, oh yeah, we did the thing. And same with Facebook, all these other large groups. And I don't disagree with it, but it's like he's done things, in my opinion, instigating conflict with these other nations is via a social media platform is a lot scarier to me. I mean, I know this had like real world implications that we all saw, but I don't think this is out of line from what he had been doing. And it's like, Twitter, why were you not doing this? If this is really the issue, you should have done this
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. That's a really good point. You gotta love how Zuckerberg, right? He's like, oh yeah, I've made money off of letting him kind of pop off for the past 4 years, but you know, now that he's on his way out, you know, we'll remove him just so that we can say we removed the guy who tried to overthrow the U.S. government.
Well, like they've gotten everything they needed monetarily from Trump being on their platform. Yep. That now it's like he's on the way out. Okay, he's a wasted asset.
I think it's very well probably based on the profit motive, but I don't think it's based on the profit motive in the same way you guys are thinking. I don't think they're like, oh, Trump, this guy's going to raise our assets. I think that by enforcing or not enforcing, by taking on that question, social media companies, private companies are incurring liabilities. Are we going to get sued? Are we going to be the target of congressional action? And I think that their actions have been based in large part on avoiding those types of suits.
So it's just damage control at this point.
I think so. And I think that part of the reason that, hey, we're going to ban Trump at the end of his term because of something that was very, very, very clearly harmful to democracy, our country, causing violence, all that stuff, that they were able to make that decision in a way where it was like, okay, this is our best course of action to avoid liabilities.
Yeah, I mean, two lawsuits, right? Parler sued, I know they sued Amazon over suspending the servers. Didn't they also sue... No, they sued Amazon over, like, quote, being a monopoly, like, kind of bullying them out. Well, they sued YouTube. It was a far-right video sharing service has sued Google for pushing YouTube over their video service.
Well, and again, it comes back to Amazon having a lot of web hosting services locked up under their control. And also another thing that's interesting to note about the Parler shutdown, right, is allegedly there's been a lot of data that's been seized by hackers, because apparently Parler was such a messed up system that you had to provide them basically your social security and driver's license to like send DMs. So they actually had a lot more information on their users than like was anticipated. So it's just the Parler rabbit hole goes deeper and deeper, and you can get mad at them for being a conservative bastion or whatever. But it's also like they took a lot of people's personal information that they shouldn't have.
Well, yeah, and here's
I didn't even know that.
And like, imagine if you were like a person who went on there to troll, right?
Yep.
Now they have your data, and it's like, ah, shit, man, I shouldn't have.
I can't even imagine going on a social media site and then being like, oh, your license number, your social security. I'd be like, I'd be out of there so quick.
I do not want a blue check that badly. If I get a blue check, you guys know I've been sold out.
I even hesitate to give social media sites like my like personal, like professional email, like the email that I use for like actual communications. I'm like, oh, do I have a junk email I could use? Like, so it's just like even less traceable. Like, I don't know. I feel like maybe that's sketchy, but like, I can't imagine going on a site and trusting them to have, especially when you think of like the kind of rhetoric you hear around like right wing in those right wing spaces. Like, there's a lot of mistrust. There's a lot of like assumptions that there's someone else kind of brewing underneath, and to assume that these people are going on the social media platform and being like, oh yeah, okay, I'll give you my social, like, what, like, what
it's are you thinking? It's the ultimate right-wing contradiction of, we can't let our elected officials that we can control, we can't let them collect our data, but when it comes to some faceless CEO that 95% of us don't even know the name of, oh hell yeah, I'll give him my social, I'll give him my driver's license, whatever, man, it'll be fine, I'm sure. You know, nobody ever did anything bad for profit.
That's probably rooted in ignorance of what that data is being used for. I mean, I doubt that everybody is like signing on thinking that this data is being sold to third parties or, you know, used in a way that the user might not be aware of. I do want to not to go back, but I mentioned that Ron Paul was banned from Twitter. It was actually Facebook. I just wanted to correct that. But yeah, going back to what we were saying, I think a lot of that is rooted in ignorance, not blatant hypocrisy.
I have this this clear memory, and I want to say that I was in high school, and it was the first time I ever uploaded a photo to Facebook, and then it auto suggested somebody to tag based on their face. And I kind of came, I put it together. I was like, wait a minute, Facebook is storing are faces.
It is a literal book of faces.
Exactly. And that's just one of those things where, you know, coming off of when I was in high school, it was the Obama era. There was the big Edward Snowden, the NSA controversy had kind of really kicked off, and the government collecting your data. And that's when we really started having that conversation over mass data collection and everything. And I just remember sitting here thinking, I'm like, everybody's freaking out about the NSA collecting, you know, your phone number and everything. Facebook can literally program a camera to pick your face out of a crowd of people. It's like, how does that not terrify people as much? And don't get me wrong, I don't want to say the NSA should be collecting your info. I'm just going to throw that out there. I'm not an advocate for data collection. But it's just so interesting to me to see people so bothered when it's the government. But then when it's somebody like, you know, Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, it's like, what makes you trust Mark Zuckerberg more than you trust like the people you voted for?
The FBI or CIA could pull your data under a warrant or even without a warrant these days, right? With the FISA courts and shit they got going on. But you know, if it's stored somewhere, someone's going to see it.
It's not just, you know, you think, oh, you know, it's if I'm just careful around the big tech giants, I'll be okay. No, I mean, even sometimes people will like voluntarily give this stuff away. You download the McDonald's app to your phone and it's like, McDonald's app, you might be able to get good deals on there, but at what cost? The McDonald's app is like, we would like access to your, you know, your contacts, your email address, your friends list, your soul, your and it does your photos, your videos. It's like literally it gives like
it's like, why do they need my photos?
Why do you want my photos?
Yeah. Well, I think actually kind of going on this like mistrust, right? Like when it comes to the government versus big companies, I almost feel like, and I'm gonna get a little nerdy for a second, but when it comes to like our media, that's sort of what the narrative tends to be. So if you think of like a lot of films or movies, it's always like the government does something awful and then there's this like ragtag group of like people rebelling against it. And like we have this in our like, we're kind of bombarded with that constantly from like a young age. And I feel like all of our media is centric around that, especially America with our like all this history we're so proud of like bucking against this big monarchy and oh, look how great we did, and conveniently leaving out that France paid for most of it. Like we just like don't talk about this stuff in a way that I think we like to think about like throwing the government off of us. It's this oppressive thing. It's things we learn about as opposed to we don't talk about how corporations have instigated really awful political situations in a lot of different countries and have done all these terrible things in the U.S. even. I mean, we don't, that's not part of like what we learn or what our media talks about. And so I almost feel like there's an idea in our head about like the government bad because of all the stuff we consume.
Yes.
And private good because we don't talk about it in like a public sphere.
Right. And I mean, that's where, you know, Slavoj Zizek in his works, he touches on ideology is the thing you believe when you don't believe anything else. Even if you yourself believe you don't believe in anything. I mean, you know, those kind of stories that you take in or the kind of narrative you tell yourself, it eventually you feel like it's true, even if, you know, the reality around you doesn't seem to support that.
This is probably the farthest I'll hop away from social media, but it just kind of goes along that line of what we talk about and what people learn about. I cannot tell you how many people I've met in my life that when I explain to them how back when the labor movement was really kicking off, how these people who were trying to organize unions would just, they would full on disappear. They would have their legs broken. They would get the crap, the tar beaten out of them. You know what I mean? And the fact that it was these private companies that were paying people to take out union organizers, you know, and it's just one of those things where everybody pictures the big, bad, oppressive government. It's like, well, corporations were doing the same thing. You know, they were fighting to stop organizations that were trying to prevent child labor, that were trying to push for equal wages, that were trying to push for, you know, workers' rights. And they were arguably just as bad as any oppressive government has been. And it's just people just don't know that. That's just not what we talk about.
Well, no, and if you go deeper into those stories, right, you look at who some of these people giving the beatdowns were, it was the Pinkertons. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, people who served at the discretion of the federal government in those cases.
Yeah, I do want to throw out with this, again, kind of off social media, but for anyone who wants to learn about that stuff, the Triangle Shirtwaist Company and all the protest for just that and all the unionizations and all the horrible fire that happened is a really depressing but easy jumping off point to start learning about that kind of stuff. Again, depressing, fair warning, but as we are taking this detour away from social media for a moment, going to plug that as a historical event to easily understand this stuff and then circle back to what our discussion actually is supposed to be.
It's a shame oh, go ahead.
We were talking in our previous episode of the podcast about separation of powers. I mean, it's maybe just a good analogy when you look back at the foundation of our country and the three branches and then the dual sovereignty, federal and state sovereignty, that prevents the power from pooling all in one place, because they say that absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think when you give corporations power, any one corporation or the government, any one actor or body too much power, you start to see those things happen. So when corporate bosses back in the day were able to go unchecked and beat up union workers, I mean, that's a power problem. So I don't know. I think that the only real difference between a government doing it and a corporation, say one of many in a nation, is magnitude and what each party has the ability to do. Government inherently has a coercive power. They can make you do things. Whereas corporations don't have those official channels.
Well, I was just going to add, like, they don't have official means of coercion. They have unofficial means of coercion. But yeah, Gabby, you were saying.
Oh, I was just going to say that I also think when we talk about government, and this kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier, people talk about government like this kind of, especially in the U.S. context, is like this one collective thing. And like, we all know, like, government in the U.S. is like highly fragmented. It's not like one amalgamous, like, this is the government and it does things, like, especially in the U.S. where, like, this, our structure is inherently designed to not be that way. So you have states doing whatever the hell, you have local governments doing whatever the hell. So I think too, when we have these conversations and people want to like sling, oh, the government, it's like, but what government are you talking about? You might be talking about the federal government. You probably are, but that doesn't mean anything to say the government.
It's the government. You go to a building and it has government on the top.
It's
government. 1-800 government. Government at Hotmail.
Governmentjobs.usa.
It's funny to say that, Zach. I currently work for a small municipality in Michigan, and I can think of at least three separate occasions where I have been asked to help people file for like state and federal programs, whether that be like, at one point someone wanted me to like accept their federal tax return or something. And I'm like, I work for your township. I cannot, why are you calling me right now? And it's just so like, it feels like one of those things that people should just kind of know, but not everybody does. And it's just,
Well, you have entire, it's kind of interesting. You have entire nonprofits. So here I am. You have entire nonprofits that exist to bridge those gaps too, because state governments and federal governments don't really talk, or state to state, they don't talk. And so when you have these people filling out forms for aid or whatever it might be, you have actual organizations that function specifically to be like, all right, so you qualify for X thing from this government and Y thing from this government. And this government gives this government money to do this, but you need to go through this channel to get it. And it's almost this kind of interesting spot where like nonprofits can exist to try to make that process streamlined because it's so fragmented. It's kind of interesting in the way that functions, I think. It's my two cents.
Oh, absolutely. And really the shame is that this is going to sound weird because it's going to sound like I'm saying you shouldn't have a job, but those organizations shouldn't have to exist. I think it's a quote from Parks and Rec where they're like, you shouldn't have to have a law degree or like, you know, a higher level degree to not be taken advantage of by what is it, like large corporations or something. I don't know the quote, but I would say, to understand the way that the government that is supposed to work for you runs, you shouldn't have to have nonprofits and different organizations that explain to you how it works.
And nonprofits, I mean, and it's not even insulting because like nonprofits exist. A good nonprofit is going to have a mission that they are trying to basically eradicate the thing they exist for, right? Like, if you do support services for someone who's a survivor of like intimate partner violence, your other goal should be to eradicate intimate partner violence. You're not going to, but like your goal should be that. You should be working to make yourself out of a job is kind of the idea. So like 100%, like they function out of necessity because this is such a, it's a, governments speak a different language. Maybe we can get this back to the social media piece in this because social media functions, I think, in a good way for there to be quick, easy communication. And for, as we're seeing, people to understand complex political topics, complex government structures and things that work in a more digestible way or a way that might be easier to understand. You see elected officials on social media platforms explaining usually really complex like policy stuff that they're running for and trying to make it accessible to get people to understand it a little better. But it's because government is so, it's so messy. It's so messy and difficult.
It can be messy. And, you know, all of us have some education in government. I think that was a perfect segue back to social media too, by the way. But Tyler mentioned something like, you know, you shouldn't have to, and I totally agree with the sentiment. You shouldn't have to have advanced degrees to understand the complex workings of the government, but the government's functions are necessarily complex. I mean, democracy, any form of government really, but I feel like especially democracy in our system of so many moving parts are, you know, dual sovereignty system, our three branches, our all of that. It's very complex. I mean, just get into one specific subset of democratic governance, elections administration. And that, you know, when I was, before law school, I was working in elections administration for a local municipality. And there are so many moving parts. It is very hard work to make sure democracy runs. But, you know, and I think that, Gabby, what you mentioned about social media is the kind of other part of the picture. You have these government officials trying to communicate these complex processes or what they feel about these complex processes, but they do so in five sentences. And you can't keep people's attention on the information you want to convey when there's all this other competing information out there buzzing around. So social media almost necessarily, I guess, I don't, what's the word, trivializes or makes it simple. Yeah.
It makes, that's what I meant last week when I said it democratizes. Oh boy, folks, I'm really sorry if you heard me eating pizza rolls on the mic. I'm gonna try to find a way to fix this.
I don't think we heard you.
You guys didn't hear me, but
dude, you just ratted on yourself, man.
Well, I'm gonna be honest, okay? I will be honest.
You could have blamed Zach, the centrist here.
No. I apologize for the audio issues, folks. We're a baby show. We're self-funded and, you know, self-taught. I'm gonna do what I can to fix that, but you know, if you hear me chewing, I'm sorry you had to hear that.
Hey, don't stress yourself out about it. Now, I think one other, and please stop me if this is segueing to a new topic and y'all want to continue on this one a bit more, but I think another important thing to talk about is how really the role that social media kind of plays right now, because it doesn't matter if you're a local government, if you're a public school, if you're a private school, if you're a nonprofit, if you're a small business, if you're a multi-million-dollar business, everybody has to use social media. Or else you're not functioning properly, right? So kind of looping back to the topic of being banned on social media platforms. When you really think about how, and maybe invasive is the right word, that social media is to the functioning of almost every aspect of our society at this point, we really probably should start thinking of some very strict limits of who exactly is allowed to be banned. Because what happens if Twitter suddenly decides, oh, your public school or your private school or whatever isn't allowed to be on our platform anymore and thus is not allowed to access hundreds and hundreds of potential customers / whatever? Don't get me wrong. I think that banning Trump, I think that banning people advocating for violence was a very, very good move personally. But I think it is important that we, as a society, and then obviously as like decision makers, lawmakers, what have you, start drawing some lines here. There are lines to be drawn, and I think it's important that we start thinking about that. Where are they? What do we say?
Yeah, I'm gonna say I think that that's mostly the right question. I think you don't want to say who should be banned, but rather what content should be prohibited, and it probably should follow along the lines of generally accepted morals or laws. I mean, we in this country, the First Amendment's pretty strong, very strong protection, as it should be. And we especially want our democratically elected officials to be able to communicate with their constituents. Maybe who, you know, in terms of if you're the U.S. president, makes it a little bit higher of a bar to be banned. Maybe that's a good thing. But in terms of what, I mean, the First Amendment doesn't protect the incitement of violence. It doesn't protect, you know, a lot of threats, serious threats. And it doesn't affect, you know, defamation, for instance. You know, maybe those things in terms of what should be banned, you know, maybe that can follow along. And I know, you know, Twitter, Facebook, et cetera, you know, you can express your First Amendment rights on there, but it is also a private company. I don't know if that's the exact status it should be. Where we talk about what it is, what it should be, maybe it shouldn't be an entirely private space because this is how people communicate now. Go ahead.
You know, I just want to kind of jump in here for a second. And so I think that makes sense, but I do think there would have to be, so you don't want to like overregulate a space, right? As long as government goes, because we know that like overregulation or like trying to put every specific rule around something doesn't typically work. It just creates a lot of complexity, and then loopholes inevitably happen. Like, they're going to be there. But I do think when you're talking about that, my brain went to like forums or websites that are designed for specific types of topics. So like, if you make like a law that says like, okay, you can't ban someone unless they're doing something like inciting violence or, you know, whatever have you, right, this list of things, and you say to social media platforms, this is what you need to abide by, right? You can't just ban someone because like you don't like the color red and they wear the color red in their profile picture. Like, that's not cool. But I'm thinking of like websites or forums or spaces that are designed for specific topics. So like, if I'm going to go on a website to talk about books, right, I'm a reader too, and it basically the guideline is like, hey dude, like you can't be posting about stuff that's not like book related. Like, that's just not why we're here. Like, only post about books. And I start like going on about exactly this. So I don't know like what we're talking about right now. And they decide to ban me. They say like, all right, no buddy, like that's not why we're here. Bye. I feel like that would be completely possible to take a rule that's intended for a larger social media platform that's more open and be applied to these kind of niche spaces that are like not meant for certain topics and like kind of limit that ability. I'm not going to say it's like the biggest issue in the world, but it does kind of open those doors to potential problems that like wouldn't otherwise exist due to some regulation that's hard to implement, especially because the way we solve things in this country is to sue. A lot of times it's a lawsuit, which I have inherent problems with already, but it's kind of difficult because it presents these other weird problems that you wouldn't expect exactly how every law tends to.
Yeah, no, that it's a complex, it's absolutely a complex topic. And I mean, you're speaking my language. I don't want to overregulate an otherwise free space either. You know, it's definitely, you know, we talked and maybe this is, you know, it's kind of related to the topic of cancellations, because I mean,
before we shift into that discussion that never ends, I do have one question for you. Is there, do we have ways to regulate commons in the United States, or have we largely eliminated the idea of a commons?
I'm sorry, what you said commons?
Yeah.
like a common forum.
Well, but it's just like commons. You know, like there would be commons in like mid, like England, and like at that time there were lands that were just not owned by anyone. Everyone theoretically had to share them, and that's where, you know, natural resources tend to fall under that kind of legal view. The internet has been considered the public library, right? But it's like, well, that's public ownership, right? So maybe do we treat the internet like a publicly owned like commodity?
We should.
It might be one way to look at it is that, you know, the government probably owns the internet, but then has to implement, you know, stricter free speech standards at the cost of, you know, being able to regulate it a little more stringently, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just like Gabby said, I mean, it's one of those things where there's, and this goes back to another public administration concept, where it's, there are things that arguably should be privately owned, maybe most things. But there are, or maybe this is touching on economics too, but there are things that are public goods, public services, you think about education, defense, things of those nature that serve a large public service that, you know, arguably should be a protection that applies or benefit that applies to everybody. And the internet as a public good or public service, or even, you know, the ability to maintain an online presence could be regarded as a public service, but it's currently maintained by many corporations, private interests. And I'm not saying that I necessarily think that maintaining social media through private organizations is a bad thing. I mean, it's gotten us, for better or worse, it's gotten us where we are. Maybe those workers are the best apt to run the social media organization, but I'm not opposed
to. So what if we nationalize them? Like, you know, Facebook still exists, Twitter still exists, but we nationalize it.
I don't know if I'd be totally in favor of the government commandeering those organizations. I would be okay with the government passing some, you know, protective rules, if you will, that preserves people's rights to free speech or something, for instance, on a platform like Twitter or Facebook or Instagram.
Well, and this is my perspective on the concept of nationalization, is I think there are definitely some industries that could be nationalized. I think when it comes to social media, I think the solution is definitely more regulation than it is like nationalizing. I think, you know what's kind of funny? When you really think about this issue, right? Whether or not the president should be banned from social media, whether or not certain Republican politicians should be banned. Wouldn't it just be nice if we had politicians that weren't advocating for violence? Isn't that ultimately just the solution? Because like social, like Twitter, Facebook, they weren't banning the president. Back when the president wasn't an asshole. I was hesitating on cursing, but then I remembered that eating ass was discussed last week.
Yeah, we have explicit tags on this program.
Swear away. It was discussed by some, but not all.
Back when the president wasn't an asshole, back when, you know, we had U.S. senators not advocating for an overthrow of the government, U.S. House reps, what have you, this wasn't a problem. You know, it's just so unfortunate that the solution is now becoming... And don't get me wrong, I have no sympathy for Mark Zuckerberg or, you know, whoever runs Twitter. I think it's Dorsey. I have no sympathy for those people, but it is rather unfortunate that they're kind of, in a way, getting screwed over by the fact that we have elected such assholes in this country, that it's that much of a problem that they have to make decisions and they have to start regulating it.
So maybe it's more so looking at the fact that, you know, is it social media or is it just the fact that we live in a sick society on top of that? And social media just makes it more apparent how sick it is.
Well, I kind of, this goes back to something I had said a little bit earlier, but I'm a firm believer that I don't think elected officials should have, like, I'm okay with them interacting with their bases on Twitter and, like, kind of pushing policies that they think are important, especially when it comes to, like, a rep trying to gain traction for an issue area, but...
Yeah,
I take issue. Like, it's okay that you know, Obama, if Obama ever posted something kind of fun, like him playing basketball with someone, I don't really freaking care. But if, like, when Trump's, like, making comments about, like, actual, like, things he's doing as the president on his Twitter, like, I have an inherent problem with that. Like, I don't think that belongs on Twitter. I think that belongs in, like
what kind of tweets? So the ones where it's like, I'm on Air Force One, heading to Tampa, like, those kinds of, or, like, what do you mean?
No, those are, like, if he's updating about what he's doing, I don't really care. But, like, in terms of him, you know, oh, God, now my brain is, like,
empty. The North Korea situation.
Like, things that are, like, would be under the purview of, like, a presidential duty. Like, something that's, like, his responsibility as the president. Oh, I don't think should have a
You mean that
on
one
Twitter.
Where it's, like, we're activating Bill Barr on all these people in the...
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Like, no, that shouldn't be on Twitter. Like, that should be an official announcement. Because here's the thing is that, yeah, we're talking about how everyone uses Twitter. But, like, they don't, actually. Like, yes, everybody does. But, like... there are a lot of people in this country, and one of the biggest voting groups is older people, like the elderly, like we know this, and they don't really use these spaces. Like, they shouldn't be kept in the dark because we can't put a freaking, like, official announcement out, like, that's actually from the president's office. Like, that, I have a problem with the official communications going through Twitter, and that's what happened a lot during the Trump presidency, yeah. And I don't think it's happening during the Obama administration or before.
Orders on Twitter, and then, like, when military people were asked, they're like, we had no such order come to us. Were we supposed to read it on Twitter?
Like, that shouldn't be okay. Like, and so you have American people who think he ordered this, and you have the actual functions of the government going, well, he never put the official announcement out there, so, like, no? Like,
well,
I don't know. Maybe it's crazy.
At the risk of just turning this conversation at a 90-degree angle and just, you know, going really off, maybe ultimately the solution to social media is not necessarily regulating social media. It's actually making sure that the people that use it are educated on it and making sure that the people that we elect into these offices who have that opportunity, because everything you just described,
Tyler, you know, what you're saying is we need to lift our crumbling school public education system out of the darkness and actually fund civics and history education. Is that what you're telling me?
But damn right,
let me,
we
let
do.
Me say something too. Let me say something. So,
yeah, go
so here's the thing, and I think this is one again another public administration concept. But I mean, I was taught in one of our master's classes that, you know, when you're implementing a policy, whether that be as a CEO, a mayor, you know, some public official trying to solve a problem, when you get to the point where you're trying to quote unquote spread awareness of an issue or educate, it's one of, and maybe this is just a professor's opinion, but I profoundly agree with it. That I think that's very one of the, I don't want to I think that plays an important piece. That's an important piece of the puzzle, but I don't think that would be very effective. That would be maybe one of the least effective things to do, because there are like people who have gone through public school systems such as mine, where it was, you know, thankfully I'm well funded, very fortunate to have a good education, public school system. But there are people who go through those classes there where, you know, I feel like I've learned so much. They actively deny the science behind vaccines. They deny the theory of evolution. They deny, they think that, you know, some, you know, lesson in the history book was written against the Confederacy. Like, you know, it's stuff like that where you're only going to be able to do so much if you try to educate people on civics, because they will continue to believe they're bad, you know, tribalistic, insert other adjective here, take on science and history. Well, and maybe that's part of the puzzle, but it's definitely not the full picture.
Well, so then how do we build a civics or a civic culture that doesn't suck? Because it's kind of fallen into the purview of like nerds like us who, you know, I was a good boy. I looked at the norms. I followed them. And largely speaking, we're now in an age where people can flagrantly deny them and hold influence and power. So what is it going to take? Because it can't just be the nerds like who follow the rules. It has to come from some degree of like day-to-day American culture that, you know, either our culture's lacking or, you know, people are more alienated and that makes us prone to be more insensitive. Maybe that's the case. But there has to be some kind of civic minded element to this on top of, you know, let's say fixing education or regulating social media. So where do you get to that?
I'm going to come in here with something that might feel out of left field, but I don't think it is. I feel like part of the problem is, so a lot of people don't have time in this country to actually deeply engage with these kind of topics. I mean, right now in this space, we have 3 people who have their MPAs. It's kind of in our education and kind of in the thing we do to know about this stuff. Like, we have to know about it or we're not being effective in like our spaces. And so I think most people in there, they work a lot, a lot, and they don't have the time to be engaging with these topics in a meaningful way. And because I think people are overworked and they're stressed and they're angry because they're overworked and there feels like there's a lot of injustices, it makes it really easy to latch on to things that confirm your own bias, that make it seem like the world is really unfair and like you're living in it. Like, I think it becomes we need that civics education, but I think it does go that step further of like, we're just kind of unhappy as a country because we work a lot and we're stressed and we're competitive and individualistic, and these things are all kind of in one big pot, and it causes a lot of anger and negativity. I
agree with you 100%, and like, I've kind of brought this up in other spaces too of like, well, it seems like people are miserable and that, you know, people are working longer and harder hours for less money like as the years go on. And I remember bringing that up somewhere, either on a forum or some website, and the immediate response was, we'll go and find a better job. So like, the ideology is so deeply ingrained that I think
there was a so I just randomly, can we get an F in the chat for the American worker? I think it's just one of those things. A couple years ago, I had the chance to go to a screening for a Michael Moore movie, and it was called Where to Invade Next. Mm-hmm. And it was Michael Moore traveling around to a couple different countries, talking about different aspects of those countries that he believed should be brought back to America. And one thing that he pointed out is that in several European countries, it is so much easier to just live and to work. And it's little things like the fact that you're provided more vacation time than you are here in America.
Or parental and maternal leave, for that matter, right?
Or healthcare is not tied to your job, so you can leave your job if you want to.
You can work a part-time job in Europe, and you can have healthcare, you can have a guaranteed retirement, because that is just something that you just get for living in that country. You just get healthcare, you just get to retire at some point. So what happens in between? You have the freedom to work a part-time job and then pursue your passions, stay engaged, stay educated. You don't have this constant, like, I need to constantly be working. Like right now, so for example, I'm currently approaching 25. I'll be 25 in a month. And then I now have 1 year to get into a job that provides me healthcare, or I am boned. I have, just for some context, I have several pre-existing medical conditions where if I, you know, lose that coverage, even for like a month, I am going to be boned. So it's just one of those things where I now have to dedicate most of my free time and like my waking hours to figuring out how to get into a full-time job.
But Tyler, so you could just apply for COBRA.
Sign up
for COBRA. Please don't do that.
No, never. But it's just one of those things where now, in theory, even me, who's a person who's tried to remain rather engaged, if I'm unfortunate enough where I end up in a situation where I have to take a crap job that I hate, that works me to the point where I am not able to have the energy when I'm out of work to be engaged in government, in what's going on. There was a point I was going, I guess I totally agree with Gabby. I think Gabby has just hit at one of the core beliefs of, honestly, like, democratic socialism, and like one of the big things about wanting to engage or kind of reform American society is to move to that point where we have the ability to be engaged and educated and what have you.
I share your sympathies for, with regards to healthcare. You know, I about to turn 26 myself, and I'm in school. I left a full-time job to go there. It was very hard to leave that full-time job. So that is definitely a difficulty with which I sympathize. And there's definitely improvements to be made to that system. I wanted to say though, that although I totally understand the point about the American worker, and it's difficult for the American worker. And when people are working so hard, and they are, that it's really, I think your point was going to be that it's much more difficult to stay involved, stay on top of all the facts and all the information that are going around, stay, well educated with regards to civics. That point is well made. But that doesn't stop people, from going on social media. So they still are. The American worker is still going on social media. And I don't know, picture somebody, I guess, for all of us, I don't know, or for any of us on the other side of your respective part of the political compass or political spectrum. And they're going on and they're consuming information and they're posting often, like all the people posting on Senator Mitt Romney's Facebook post, just this blatantly false information. If they have the time to go on social media and they're still deliberately consuming all this false information or false information, whether misinformation or disinformation, then they arguably have the duty or responsibility to inform themselves. They're consuming something. Just make sure that you're consuming the right thing. Well, so while I share these for the American worker, they still have a responsibility to stay informed. That's how our society functions, and we're collectively failing at that responsibility.
Well, to touch on that point a little bit, because I get what you're saying, that staying informed should be a matter of personal responsibility. I agree with that to an extent. But the people who really are religiously into promoting this kind of right-wing misinformation, I have found at least, are more on the type of demographics to have that free time. They do work times where they work with more standard hours of 9 to 5. They do seem to be people in charge of their own businesses and things like that. So it's kind of interesting to also look at it in that sense of, there seems to be a shift from those people who would traditionally make up the establishment Republican base have now basically gone on the Trump train fully. And those would be the people that we would reasonably expect to stay informed, but I guess for whatever reason now have kind of abandoned that kind of shared facts.
I agree it's especially bad on I don't know, for lack of a better term phrase, that side of political ideology. But anybody from me, probably a leaning liberal centrist, to anybody else, you can describe yourselves. We're not immune to it. And we often fall for it. I'm not just saying, the other side is falling for the Republican propaganda. I mean, I think there is a point to be made that it might be particularly bad on that side, quote unquote, but it affects a lot of people. I mean, there are, especially with, social media and all the algorithms, or you go on YouTube, and if you're on one side of the political spectrum, you're going to be seeing Stephen Colbert, the Late Show.
Just really bad content, by the way. Stephen Colbert has gotten worse over the years. I will defend that.
It's kind of the last several episodes just seem like progressive propaganda to me. And when you're just saying words that like President Trump criminally incited the riot at the Capitol, you might have a point that he, in his collective actions over the past month and a half, whatever, have brought about incitement of the Capitol riot. But when you say things like criminally incited,
well, it pipes up that liberal hysteria that I take issue with. You know what I mean? That I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to circle back on something. So if you have something directly with Stephen Colbert, go, please.
Oh my! I'm trying to remember what I was going to say, actually.
Well, let me then just while you're remembering, you know, it gets to the point where for anybody who's listening who happens to be, you know, a self-described liberal, progressive, Democrat, whatever, did you listen to Trump's speech? Do you know what about it you find to be criminally inciting? If you're not asking yourselves these questions, well, then you might be.
And that's the thing, because when you only talk about it as a criminal thing, right, you forget the fact that Trump went on stage for half an hour to complain about Oprah. If you actually look at this, it's quite hilarious what happened. And now I remember what I was going to say is, like, I have some unsubstantiated rumors I've heard that Trump was actually horrified when he saw them storm the Capitol. Like, he didn't really think they were going to do it. So it's funny to see how much disdain Trump actually has for the people who are willing to do all this violence for him. But
yeah.
But again, it's like, you know, we kind of look at it as Trump directly commanded them. No, Trump just said what he had to save face. We all know to an extent that he didn't expect to win the presidency, but we knew that he didn't want to give it up or, you know, get defeated because he would look like a loser. It was just hoping these 8 years would go and, like, he gets something out of this. And that's the reaction I expected when I heard that rumor. Now it's not founded, so we'll have to find out.
There is there's always the it's impossible to account for human stupidity.
Mm-hmm.
And when dealing with President Trump over the past 4 years, it's always been a constant kind of tightrope between so is he doing this because it actually benefits him, or is he actually just a dumbass who does not understand what is happening around him and the implication of what he's doing? Now, that doesn't excuse him from anything. I think this is where the importance of actually pushing investigations and actually having some kind of follow-up on these things. Because ultimately, the four of us sitting here, we don't have any type of authority to officially determine what President Trump has done. Does that cross the line into criminally inciting violence? We can't determine that, but you know who can is, like, actual investigations done by FBI, Congress, whatever organization that you think.
And this gets into another thing I've just been thinking about lately is why all this talk about starting a Patriot Act number 2, or this kind of discussion about, oh, you know, it's a racist mob, and, like, it was to an extent, but there was this big talk about we got to open up an investigation, we got to do this, we got to do this. But theoretically, can't they get all these guys on a misdemeanor, in theory, and then take it up from there? Why was there all this stalling about, like, what we should do? Do you have the apparatus to punish them right then and there?
Yeah, you could at bare minimum hit them with something small like unlawful assembly, which is what a lot of people, it basically just means you collected where they didn't want you to collect in a way that made them feel scared. So, I mean, if you really want to hit them with something small, breaking that kind of has nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not even small. Like, breaking into the Capitol should not even be small.
If you wanted to just hit them with something that's easy to wide sweep, hit everybody with, that's something very, and that's what a lot of protesters during BLM were hit with, was like unlawful assembly. It kind of means nothing, right? Like, it means something, but it means nothing. So you can easily hit everybody who showed up there with this kind of minor thing, and then if you find that this person, further investigation finds that they stole or they broke something or, you know, whatever, there's plenty of photo evidence, you could theoretically
there was plenty of photo evidence in this case. Yeah. Like, they were posting it on their Twitter live. I mean, like, you had,
look at me break this thing.
I saw this post that was, it was kind of taking the it was kind of like making fun of everything that was happening here, but it was a post where it said, hey everybody, President Trump is handing out free pardons, you know, just comment your name, your address, exactly what crimes you committed, etc. That's what people were doing. They were, hi, this is me, I am actively, like, taking Nancy Pelosi's mail.
No, which, but is, that's what they did, that's property. What they did.
Yeah, and it's just, yeah, I mean, at least all the complaints about social media, and this is kind of, when you guys were talking last week, one of the positives that I did want to just bring up with social media is that it's great that when video evidence of things is so readily available now, whether it be the people who stormed the Capitol, like, posting actual evidence of the crimes they committed, or the direct videos of police officers beating unarmed people at the various BLM protests. That is one good thing about social media, has been the dissemination of just, here's the proof. It's right fucking here. It takes no effort. Like, just here's the video.
Or even seeing that that's not I mean, if we're calling back to the BLM protests, we're even seeing that because in terms of like police officers, right? We all know that that doesn't always mean anything, right? Because they have qualified immunity and things, you know, all these buzzwords, things that people are not familiar with that we've all learned through a 5-sentence social media post. We all know that those things actually didn't come of anything. So that kind of draws up bigger questions of like, it's great that now there's this just pure truth to this. Like you can't like say it any other way, but then you do have people who see videos and they say like, well, we don't really know what was happening before they started taking the video. I mean, they could have been instigating this whole, and you're like, okay, like people are always trying to call around it, right?
I feel like I'm the guy who's just being like, yeah, but that's my role here. I was gonna say, like, while I totally agree, you're able to post videos on social media, that is an often stated criticism, and sometimes the users posting the video cut out some damning piece of context, such as, oh, look, it looks like this, I don't know, I'm just making something random up, but oh, it looks like this police officer just shot somebody, you know, in cold blood, but you know, maybe that person was running at them with a machete or something. You don't see that part of the video. You just see
or the flip side, you see them running at them with a machete and you don't see the cop shooting. Well, I mean, I get that. Like that is because it's shaky camera footage, you have incentive to believe it because that's what a person on the ground could get. And on the flip side, it seems to obscure the truth just as much as it like brings the truth out.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, that's where I'm at is in a world where information's more democratized, but we don't have the same universal quality of information with each source. What are you going to do? That's the broader, problem.
I was going to say, because you said something earlier, Adi, it's like, you're like, you know, the theme behind it was, well, okay, great, we've stated the problems. Now, what do we do about it? You know, if education's not the role, if Tyler's right and you can't account for human stupidity, which I think that's a nice quote. I think the social media giants have done, at least something right, and they could potentially go even further with this. Is when there is false information, or when there is, a dispute about the claims around an election, they have put a notice, and perhaps that notice should be, you know, bigger, larger, should have a source link to it. For instance, in a YouTube video, the AP has called the race for Joe Biden. Learn more here. And on Facebook, I don't know if they link, or on Twitter, I don't know if they link the source. But having like the screen be either grayed out at first, unless you click past it, or at least have something attached, like here are these independent fact checkers who have said, this is the right thing. Anybody who wants to know the true facts will be able to.
That's true. But I do think I've seen people, with those, you know, false claims, things up on their media. And the reaction I've seen from people who have gotten a lot of those claims on a lot of their posts is to share. There's those memes that go around of like, God, there's the one specifically of like Paul Revere. It's like an illustration of Paul Revere. And he's like yelling like they're coming. British. Like, it's like the British are coming thing, but it's like replaced with like whatever social media post is, or like social media platform. And it's talking about like, he's being censored. Like he's trying to give this like meaningful information that such and such is coming, and it's like Facebook has censored him, right? And so they think that these big media tech companies have like this left-wing agenda, and so they're going to keep silencing them because they have a left-wing agenda. And maybe, you know, clarifying exactly how you get censored on these social media platforms and that being across the board understood might make that better,
because
but
it's not done on any clear basis. It seems to be ad hoc, whether someone gets removed, whether someone gets blocked for a couple hours, or whether someone loses privileges. It never seems to come from the top, or if it does come from the top, it looks too obvious and they implement it pretty sloppily. So it seems to me that because of how slow they've been when it comes to choosing who to keep quiet or who to block or who to ban. It just created like a bubble that bursted in this event. Maybe we can look at it. We can look at it in that way, right?
Yeah.
Well, not even going as far to talk about bans. I had a very unique situation where I ended up, because remember back when Trump was tweeting like, "Oh, I actually won the election," Twitter put that little like exclamation point that said, "Oh, this claim is disputed. Multiple sources have called the race." You know, blah blah blah. I remember I ended up in a conversation with a random person who's connected to my family, and all he had heard is, "Oh, did you hear that Twitter is like blocking right-wing opinions now?" Like such a little thing, like putting a disclaimer, suddenly had all the. And to be honest, I think there's a lot to be said that that's done on purpose by, like, you know, for example, Trump and his supporters did, instead of explaining that this is a disclaimer, they did just start flat out saying, "We are being blocked. We are being attacked. These liberal social media,"
which is histrionic. I think it should just be dismissed as histrionic behavior, if we're being honest. But
yes,
it kind of goes to show that, like, didn't these platforms always have the means to do this and are just now choosing to do it?
They did. I think, Adi, what you said earlier about there being just like unclear standards for who, like, who's blocked and why and how, and this is kind of how our conversation started, right? Yeah. And I'll just share a personal tidbit. I don't share a lot on social media. Like, I don't share a lot on Facebook. I do occasionally. I'll share an NPR article every once in a while, but it's really the, you know, extension of what I'm usually on there with. And I remember I went to make a post, and I don't even remember. I don't remember what it was in reference to. It was fairly recent. And it was something political, and I went to share it, and I shared it. It worked, but then I went to edit it because I like saw a typo or something, and Facebook had given me the notification saying like, "Oh, you can't edit this." Like, basically, my account was like locked for like that. Like, it was like something to the effect of like, it didn't give me a very clear message about what it meant, but it was essentially like, "Oh, you kind of like you've been sharing too much, so like we're not letting you edit your post." Like, I was still able to post, but I wasn't able to edit the post that I made. And I ended up deleting it because I was like, well, now I'm annoyed. But it was super strange. And like, even looking into the guidelines, like Facebook's guidelines, Googling it, trying to figure out like what this, because I can't remember what the error message said, but it was like a specific message. And I had no clue. Like, I literally could not figure out why Facebook had decided to lock my privilege to edit my own posts. Like, maybe I exceeded the amount of editing that it thought I was allowed to do. But like, I remember being on the receiving end of that and going, I maybe post like once a week, like max. I'm like, what is going on? And so I think that's really, it's just an anecdote that kind of highlights your point, Adi, of like, this stuff needs to be understood and clear. Like, there needs to be, if you're getting like blocked or you're getting your information taken down, I think it needs to be very explicit. Like, you violated X, Y, and Z of our terms of agreement. So you could go, if I wanted to, I could go to the terms of agreement and say, oh shit, I did. Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
Oh yeah, my mom got blocked from me. Because I think my mom was trying to advertise something for like a social club or something like that, and they blocked her account for like 5 minutes or something because it's like, you've been posting too much. And it's like, has she? I don't know. Like,
the fact that I have never gotten that warning and you guys are all aware of how often I randomly share crap is just, I think, a good example of this is really based on some weird... I think algorithms need to be something that is discussed more and something that is made more publicly available. Because, I mean, for years, we've heard random comments on, like, the YouTube algorithm, on the how is Facebook recommending things to you kind of algorithm. I know that there's been a lot of conversations about kind of the odd pipeline that kind of pushes you into right-wing stuff on the internet.
I see Wish.com in the chat. That does not use an algorithm. Wish.com does not use an algorithm with the type of shit they send in my recommendations. Oh, okay.
there's an exception to every rule.
Unless they pull up like your porn history, that's the only theory that makes sense. And even then, I'm not into S&M, guys. Why is that coming up in my Wish.com feed?
Why am I getting a leather mask with what's
in it? They tried to give me a flat pool once. It was very bizarre.
Had a Wish.com sponsorship there, if we would have just said it over and over again. But I think when you brought up S&M, that you might have lost that.
No, I might get a kink.com sponsorship from that. Let's find out.
Sorry,
well,
Tyler,
so here's the thing. This is an anecdote, and admittedly this is coming from just a post that I saw kind of going viral, people talking about how it basically with YouTube autoplay, you'll start out on something like decently tame. And basically how it'll go is if you just kind of let it run, you either end up in super, super leftist space or you end up in super, super conservative space.
Are you
space.
Talking about only looking for political content? Because the right-wing political stuff seems to get recommended just by how many views it has.
Yes.
Yep. People have been talking about the weird side of YouTube for years. You know what I mean? Where you'll just be like looking your niche stuff. Like, let's say, I don't know, I was young. I was looking up like Naruto stuff, right? So I'm looking at Naruto videos.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden... top Ooh. 10 deadliest snakes. Literally the recommended just like would I like this is an anecdote, so I'm not sure how much you can verify of this, right? But top 10 deadliest snakes. Frog eats shrimp. A striptease video showed up. Like I'm not making this up. Like the weird side of YouTube has been around for a minute, so I'm not sure how long they've been testing the algorithm, and now it's at its peak, right?
Yes.
But their whole thing is it's a proprietary thing. We can't share it, but at some point, I think we're going to need either some level of administration or law enforcement that is competent in understanding technology such that they could safely make those decisions. And I think that right now, like, we're at a point where I feel like the government is still in 1950s mode. It doesn't understand how social media works.
Yes.
It doesn't understand hashtags to this point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, honestly.
This is good luck getting anyone who has like actual in-depth knowledge about how algorithms work and the tech industry. Like, imagine how much money they're making working in Silicon Valley and working with these huge tech companies to do this work. And imagine the government having to match that salary and those benefits. I feel like you'd have to find someone who feels very benevolent. And I know that there are organizations that have been founded by people who used to work doing these algorithms and now have organizations where they literally talk about what this means and what it does and how harmful it can be, which they might be the pool to pull from, but
and it's really going to be hard because it's such a lucrative industry right now.
Yeah. Like imagine trying to get we know how much governments tend to pay. I'm not going to say it's horrible, but I'm not going to say it's anything in comparison to what you would make working for one of the big tech companies in a meaningful position.
I can concur.
And it's also stressful. I mean, also the government work is, as much as corporate environments are stressful, like government work is stressful. Like even just the constant, and we'll get this on social media, but you get the constant hate of the government, right? And everyone blaming the government. And I'm just like, dude, like we're made up of elected officials that you guys choose.
Well,
like,
why do you hate us so much?
Like, come on, like you guys get to do this too. This is a whole country.
It's a bad Parks and Rec. Bad Parks and Rec.
And I guess Parks and Rec is the thing we're going to fall back on, right? But Zach, Tyler, and I used to be in a public admin class. So it was the intro to the public admin course, right? So you guys took it as your start. That was probably the only PA course I took. But literally day one, I went in and I was there as, you know, this you know, college Democrat, very wide-eyed liberal of like, I want to work at the EPA type shit. And the first lesson we got is at the level of public admin, ideology doesn't fucking matter because all you can do is the work you're set out to do with the budget you get. And everyone is trying to slash your budget. When you're in that situation,
it's depressing.
There's a cynical side to it, and it's definitely true. It's like almost everyone's always like, "Oh, those bureaucrats," which is essentially, you know, a public administrator or an administrator in the private land too. But they actually perform a very important function. You know, the political leaders set the agenda, and the administrators do it, and they do it well. And you mentioned, you know, maybe kind of cynically, like, well, ideology doesn't matter, but you can still recommend. You can still make things more efficient. You can still feel fulfilled from your job knowing that you've served. I don't know if I would want to be. To your point, though, I mean, I totally agree. I wouldn't want to be necessarily like the EPA administrator in the Trump administration because I don't know how much you're going to be able to recommend and get done.
I was thinking about that because I have classmates who want to go into federal government work, and a lot of them were like, yeah, I want to work in the federal government, but maybe not till after we get done with this election. Like, I don't think I'm going to do that. I find that with, like, I personally live in New York, and like, I don't really want to do state work in general, but the concept of working for Andrew Cuomo,
it just seems deplorable.
Doesn't sound great.
and that's, you know, with some of this, the way liberals tend to lionize their popular leaders, right? I'm sorry, Cuomo is a liberal Trump. He has the same affect. He's just as detestable. He seems just as awful to work with. The only thing I find that he does better than Trump is he's very good at making people feel like they regret being born.
Oh, oof. Oof.
Like Trump, I will say Trump seems like he's entertaining. Like he'll get like 80 pounds of cold McDonald's for the NCAA champions. That seems like a fun guy. Cuomo is just over there like, so the COVID vaccine is going to be thrown out at the end of the day. We're not going to give it to anyone who needs it. Like, just means testing to an end. That doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there's a whole rant to be had about Cuomo, but kind of looping back to the role of a public administrator. Because Gabby, what you're describing with the not being able to match the salaries of, you know, Silicon Valley when it comes to, you know, discussing algorithms and regulating them, in theory, what the government can do is have a public administrator who they're not going to learn it as well as the people who design the algorithm, but they at least are going to be able to like be tasked with talk with those people, figure out what they can do, give that information back to us, and then we'll write a law to make them do it kind of thing. That's at least a way, that is a step, that is a start that the government can at least take to regulating these algorithms. And because what these algorithms kind of end up being is they, in a weird way, you know how when you're born, your parents kind of determine a lot of like your political beliefs. Like if your parents are both Republicans, you're probably a Republican. If your parents are both Democrat, you're probably Democrat. What your social media recommends to you can also have that effect in a way. And it can kind of give you the option to be like, oh, well, here's Charlie Kirk talking about how it's women's fault that there's a pay gap and blah, blah, blah. And like, that's just what you're exposed to. So it can lead to some unfortunately wrong or incorrect opinions. And I think that that's part of tackling social media and helping social media be more productive than destructive to public discourse.
Well, I also it'll be a quick, so I think with that, going back onto our education piece, but part of that almost feels like I feel like a dick for saying this, but it almost feels like a critical thinking thing. Because like, if I see someone describing this concept to me, even if they're making some points that sound really reasonable, but I think back on the crux of their argument, which is women are reasonably paid less. Right. And I'm just like, well, wait, like, even no matter how many times I go back to that, that feels wrong. Right. I feel like we talk about, there's a lot of conversations about getting rid of like gen ed classes and like universities and like, you know, only making sure people are focusing on their specific field or whatever. And these classes like teach you how to think a lot of like your history class teaches you how to look at an argument, pick out the thesis, say, I think that's good or that's bullshit, and then look at the points that they bring up and decide if you agree with it. I mean, that's what a history degree is. Surprise, I don't know that much about history, but I do know a lot about arguing. Like, just going to say that, throw it out there, liberal education, awesome. Go ahead, Zach.
I think I forgot what I was going to say, but you brought up such a more interesting point that I wanted to talk about too. I mean, I think ideally, education turns a thinker into a critical thinker, but I don't think that necessarily happens in practice. While the gen eds should serve an important function, they don't always, and then that leads into, oh well, now the university is siphoning money away from people and they're not using that. I mean, I could think back to a literature class I had that, you know, I probably got more in high school or you know, in a different writing class than I did from that class. I mean, I know that's anecdotal, but I'm sure a lot of people have that understanding too. I wish we could find a way in education to turn a thinker into a critical thinker, but just because somebody goes to higher education, just because somebody has a gen ed course, just because somebody, takes, you know, writing and rhetoric or a math, you know, formal reasoning course, doesn't mean that they're going to get anything from it.
I have a bit of an idea on how we deal with that. And I think the issue just stems with the fact that you have to pick a major. You only get to be an expert in one thing, right? And I think the interdisciplinary or multi-disciplinary approach makes more sense in this case, because as I keep saying, everything is everything. You can't just have an issue exist in a vacuum. It has social causes, it has political causes, it has economic causes. You can talk about the sociological things that happen at play. So even in something like, you know, I majored in environmental science, right? And I took ecology, I took, you know, water resource management, stuff like that, right? And then I'm interspersed with things like public administration, economics, the kind of things you have to do to pull a project together. And when we have liberals saying we need to believe science, well, believe science to do what? It's in the case of a public health crisis, you're using the facts to save lives. That's the part that gets left out of that discussion, right? And it goes back to this, where it's cool that I got to learn all this stuff in the STEM portion, right? But then understanding that the environment is more than just a scientific construct. It's where people live. It affects their personal health. And so it's a public health thing. It's a political issue. It's a social thing, because different communities have different rates of access to things like outdoor recreation and things like that. So nothing occurs in a vacuum is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, that's 100% true. I totally agree with that. I think to Zach's point about the effectiveness of education, he just popped into the chat. Mm-hmm. I think, so instead of focusing it on higher ed, right, because not everybody goes to higher, and I don't think that's a problem, right? Something as accessible as high school education, right? Because I feel like this circles back to us not valuing teaching as a profession, and we don't get great teachers because we don't pay them very much, and we don't value them in a way that's meaningful, which is a big problem. I had some really awesome, I had some high school teachers that were much better than some college professors I had, right? But I'm imagining if every school was able to have these people, because you don't go into being a teacher because it is secure, sounds like a really easy job. Like, I don't know any teachers that do that. Everyone knows it's underpaid and it's highly stressful. So if we just value them a little, I feel like you see these people who get slowly whittled down by the fact that they're just not valued in the workplace, to eventually they're not caring anymore about teaching in a meaningful way. If we actually valued it and we did it at that high school level, because I did some classes where I learned how to critical think in high school, and it was really, really valuable. I have to throw this out here because amazing guy, but an adjunct professor at a community college who got paid almost nothing, okay, but poor man was an adjunct at a community college in a not so wealthy community. And he was amazing. Like, he taught me to critical think better than almost anyone I ever had in any setting, higher level collegiate or not. And if we valued him a little bit more, he's considering leaving education, which is a huge loss. So why we don't value them is really what I'm saying. If we did, I think we would fix this problem.
Totally, totally agree. And I just want to clarify too. I think I agree with you. The forum for nurturing critical thinking is education. I think I was just lamenting that. I wish we could do something to make it even more effective.
I feel like you can defend.
I think teachers. Yeah.
Well, no, to what your point is, like, you know, gen eds aren't the source of critical thinking, but they can be an avenue. Yeah.
Yes, they can be an avenue. I think this is just a thought that comes up while you're discussing this. How many times, so college, as of right now in the American education system, college is one of the few places that you can pretty much say there's probably someone there teaching you to be a critical thinker, or at least attempting to. There's an attempt. And isn't it also interesting that when discussing the American education system, college is the place where you'll hear people say, like, oh, those crazy liberal colleges that teach you all these things, they teach you blah, blah, blah.
Well, they say liberal professors teach you socialism. And I'm like, first of all, I don't know if they do that. A liberal professor does not teach you socialism. Yes. They teach you liberalism.
And it's one of those things where I think there is a concerted effort. And I don't think there's anyone here who would disagree that there is a concerted effort by some actors, whether intentionally or unintentionally, to devalue education. because education is that thing that ultimately, if your parents don't want you to know something about society, it's when you go out to public education, to college, you're gonna learn it. And there are some people who have a significant problem with that. There are people out there who want to have control over what values are being instilled in their children. And through that means, there are people who do actively try to stop us from learning things, who don't want critical thinking taught in college or in public schools. And that's ultimately the hurdle that we have to overcome, whether it's teaching people to be a critical thinker in the context of social media, whether it's teaching them to be a critical thinker in the context of who to vote for or how to vote or how elections work. There are always people who will make some kind of profit or benefit, or even they just don't want you to think that hard, or they don't think someone should think that hard. And that is the hurdle that we've kind of got to overcome here. And it's going to be something, you know, the four of us, we're all young people. And I know, regardless of if you're planning on having children or not, it's something to think about when you're meeting younger people, whether they be your younger siblings, whether they be your children, thinking in terms of how do I make sure that you're a good learner, you're a good thinker? How do I help beat those people who are actively trying to stop critical thinking in little ways? But
I want to tie this to something Zach has brought up multiple times, which is tribalism. But I think it kind of goes back into social media. So when you come to social media, right, it's really easy to view the world as black and white, or me versus them, or us versus them. Tribalism, here we are. And I think part of critical thinking is understanding that the world seldomly, if never, functions in that way. Like, there's nothing that is, I know my critical thinking was fostered a lot by my mother, which is like funny because it's funny now, but she really views the world in a usually a very gray way. And well, that's how she taught me to grow up, to learn how the world was gray and there was no absolutes and nothing was this or that ever. And so that made me question the world around me constantly. Like, I didn't take anything for face value almost ever because, well, everything's gray, everything can change. And I think when we get on social media, it's really easy to see I'm in this camp and this camp is right. And I have all these people backing me up and they're all liking my stuff and we're all sharing the same thing. And there's the other side and they're all wrong no matter what they say. And I think that's part of the problem, is this like black and white way that you look at the world, where you don't see things as a spectrum and you don't see things as like a transition across, where there can be gradients.
Only a Sith deals in absolutes.
Yeah, right.
There you go.
It's a very good point. My parents, my mom specifically, said to me, you know, the truth is always somewhere in the middle. And that's, it's important to see any merit that comes from any one of any side, you know, any side. I think that's very important. With regards to social media, I completely agree with you, Gabby. I think that, and this is quoting, a book loosely, called The President Is Missing. It's like a Bill Clinton and some other author book. I don't know. We're using increasingly more sophisticated, you know, increasingly sophisticated means to resort to more and more tribalistic kinds of behavior. We're going back to our default tribalism through sophisticated means. And I think that was just a really apt quote from the book. And then another idea that popped into my mind, I watched this YouTuber, Theremin Trees. He often makes comments on psychology, theology, rarely politics, but I find that this is applicable here. When he was discussing religion at one point, he said that his agnosticism is a refusal to play an infinite game. And the infinite game, if you can picture yourself in the middle of, you know, like a circular courtyard or something, there's lines going out in every direction. And there are people along any line saying, hey, come this way, come this way. This is the right way to do it. Politics can be viewed through that same lens. You have conservatives, liberals, progressives, social democrats, libertarians, all these different people along the spectrum. You have a limited time to go a certain way. You know, maybe going down any one of those tribal paths, you know, maybe that's good, maybe that's bad, but refusing to do that is a refusal to play that infinite game.
Well, I think that's what it comes back to, right? Is maybe another problem too is how we engage politics, and politics has become a spectacle and game of sorts. I don't think people are legitimately going back to politics as a way to exercise power and influence. I think it is a way to let off some steam or play a game, right? Which is why, you know, when you look at the guys who stormed the Capitol, a lot of them, their immediate reaction was, hey, it's your boy, I'm on Twitch right now. And it kind of expresses something banal about this, right? Where the stated goal was to start an insurrection. But the insurrection itself is, you know, as frightening as it was somehow banal at the same time. And I think that's another probably natural result of turning politics into spectacle rather than what it is, which is exercising power and influence.
Yeah, I think, before I kind of go off on this thought, I do want to say I'm not trying to make the case for tribalism when I say this. I'm a person who's always kind of had a team. I've always kind of put a label on myself. You know, I was a former president of College Democrats. I'm currently a precinct delegate in the Democratic Party in the state of Michigan. You know, I've always been a person who's never really hesitated to assign a label, to assign myself a tribe personally. And I understand that that's not for everyone. I think where we get to the point where there is a point where you can have a team. There is a version of tribalism that is somewhat healthy. I think what is important is when, sure, you have your team, you have your people, you have your group that you will vote for, that you will support, that you will, you know, identify yourself with. Where the line kind of gets crossed is everyone else is awful, though. Everyone else needs to go to hell. Everyone else is the worst. You know, it's important to have a team. And I think ultimately you're never going to get to a point where nobody has a tribe. What we need to start teaching is kind of healthy tribalism, where it's like, yes, you have your group and your group is fine. Your group has your own opinions.
Well, this is what I was getting at with improving our civic culture, right? And I mean, and again, like, this is what I mean by politics being turned into a spectacle and game, is that if you're trying to have a coalition that's getting power for its own goals, right? You shouldn't really care about whether everyone else is good or bad. It's just in terms of what you're organizing for, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, I also think that there's part of a problem with this. We have a really competitive culture. I mean, obviously, capitalism is kind of intrinsically tied to that. But I think even past that, we just love the idea of like competition and being competitive. And like, you do feel like you got to compete with the other people who are doing the thing, right? The other tribes who are doing these other things. And I think that's damaging. I mean, it also kind of mixes in with this, like, want to be the best all the time. Like, it's an inherently competitive thing, but it's another thing that we bolster up in our culture of, like, everyone wanting to be the best. And this is, like, prevalent with, like competition shows, which I watch. I'm, like, a huge competition show person. I don't know what my deal is. I love them. But like, they're exactly that. Like, they're toxic and they're negative, and like, it's the goal to like beat everybody out and like be just the top person. And like, we have an obsession with that. So it doesn't surprise me that like this competitiveness, this tribalism, that when people get into groups with like-minded individuals, instead of just kind of working together in a communal way to further a goal, to help others, they bunker down, they lock up, and they say, oh, everybody else over there sucks. Like, it's kind of what our entire culture does and is around. Yeah. I'm not shocked, and it's sad, but it's how we do.
Mm-hmm. I totally support, you know, free associations and belonging to a group, and even tribalism can be fun in some settings. Wanting to see the Packers destroy the Rams in the, you know, NFC playoffs. I think that just happened yesterday. That's fine. I mean, and calling, oh, those Rams fans, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. They're dumb. I mean, that's not necessarily harmful. What is harmful is saying things like, oh, the right is crazy, the left is out to get you. You know, just blatant us versus them, that couldn't get more blatant. We're using directions, left and right, to put ourselves into group A, tribe A and tribe B, and then discourse and, you know, information sources from, you know, either quote unquote side. And then, you know, it's all being polluted, and then, you know, information is necessary and friendly discourse is necessary to the maintenance of our democracy, that's when tribalism becomes becomes difficult. Being a part of the Democratic Party isn't by in and of itself any wrong. You can just freely associate with whomever you want. The moment you start saying things like you said, Tyler, where it's like, oh, all Republicans are this, you know,
Some definitely are, but not all.
Some are this, but not, you don't want to cast a wide net.
Yeah, I do want to bring up something about this, because I agree. I agree that making everybody into a monolith and deciding you hate that is like bad. It's like not, it doesn't view people in a way that is productive, I think. But I also do want to bring up, in terms of like left and right, when you do have right, and I'm going to pick on the right here, because when you do have part of the base being kind of, so if your party is advocating against something like equal marriage or like treating people in the LGBT community like they're people, and that's something that a lot of politicians in that space and in that realm and in that quote unquote tribe, right, tend to bolster up. I do think that if I have a friend who is politically right and they vote for someone who runs on a lot of things they agree with, but also, you know, limits the rights for people that I care about and myself, I am going to look at that and say, but I don't really trust you. You know, even if you're in a gradient and even if you don't really agree with that piece, that's still, to me, it's a human rights issue and it's a civil rights issue. And to say that you don't really care about that and that wasn't a deal breaker for you does give me an indication that I want to stay away from you. And I want to stay away from you if you associate with that.
I mean, I think there's a key point to be made there. And listen, this is a guy, so a little bit of background on me. I was a student body president of Oakland back in the day, big deal back in 2016. And one of the things we did was completely, absolutely advocate and successfully implement, after several, you know, previous years of student governments had failed to lobby for this, for a preferred name policy for primarily to the benefit of transgender students. I mean, this is an issue that was close to my heart. Make sure that people weren't outed on the graduation stage or harassed in class. I mean, those are things to me that are rights issues. I totally align myself with that. That viewpoint. If somebody were to vote for, I don't know, say John McCain or a Mitt Romney or even a Donald Trump because of something, you know, maybe that person, you know, doesn't believe that we should be, I don't know, supportive of some LGBT issue, just for example, but they agree with Donald Trump on a policy point of view of, you know, keeping the country safe. I'm trying to present it in the best possible light. Lower taxes, you know, being able to make everything like economically thriving, and those are the policies. Maybe somebody is weighing the lesser of two evils and finds that Donald Trump is the lesser of two evils. And I don't think that because somebody voted against somebody who doesn't, that politician who doesn't align themselves on a certain side, I don't think that they're necessarily evil or should be disassociated with. I think that people make value judgments all the time. And I think that it's worth some people have like stronger issues. For instance, a lot of people who voted for Trump were like against abortion. And that's a very important issue to them.
Well, isn't this reflective of how like the two-party system we have doesn't really represent the real factions that seem to occur, right? Because social issues seem to like now be turned on to like either axis of the culture war, and economic policy is either something you care about or you don't, right? So it's almost like we have four factions of like, you know, the social Democrats, like the Bernie-crat group, right, that is socially liberal and supports a more left-wing economic policy. You have Democrats who are socially liberal but are more on the neoliberal side. You have what's called the establishment Republicans who are neoliberal in their economics, but aren't, well, I mean, it's not clear to me on this, right, but aren't as big on the culture war stuff as the last one, which is the Trump base, right, which is both socially reactionary as well as economically. So it seems to me like this is one of those things that it's not just a matter of how people self-select and self-sort, right? It's also a fact of they are engaging with the system they have handed to them.
Yeah, I think that's that kind of what gets down to the root of the problem. And first off, I want to say, Gabby, I completely understand your point. I have had so many conversations with different people who I know who vote Republican, and I'll say like, oh, like, you know, what are your thoughts on LGBT issues? And they'll be like, oh yeah, people have the right to live the way they like, the way that you want. Or like, oh, I think, you know, people should be able to transition to whatever gender fits, you know, them the best, et cetera. And then they'll be like, oh yeah, but I voted for the guy, VP Mike Pence, who like would electroshock people. You know what I mean? It's like really hard to kind of get that dissonance, it almost feels like, where it's like, well, you're saying you support one thing, but then you're voting for people who support another. But I think to Zach's point and to Adi's point, what ultimately happens is, you know, there are people, unfortunately, you're given this checkbox or this checkbox. You're not given a person who's like, I like gay people, I support human rights, but I also want conservative economic policy. Like, you're not presented with that person currently in the current system. And I think that's a flaw. For a long time, I've thought that first past the post voting systems are just awful. It's a huge part of why we have such a dichotomy here in America, which is why I think we need more election systems that allow more of a stratification, because ultimately what you'd end up having, at least in my personal opinion, is it'd be a lot easier to push through those issues that are very slam dunk, like, do people deserve rights? Yes. If you get rid of that dichotomy and you have, say, like four political parties in America and three of them are kind of more like okay with giving people human rights, you kind of block out those people who are opposed to it. If that makes sense. I think allowing for more political parties would actually make it easier for issues that everyone can kind of agree on to get through. Because right now, you're people who support LGBT people are kind of forced to vote for people who don't, because every other one of their opinions aligns with that person who doesn't.
Yeah, and I just want to, because I had my I wasn't able to. I know I rant on for a long time, but I want to be able to basically wrap up what I was saying earlier. And to Tyler's point, I want to say amen. Like all or even none. No political parties on the ballot would be preferable to me. But basically what I was saying is that, you know, just like Tyler is alluding to, you can have a valid reason to vote for somebody, even if they're on the wrong side of an issue that's important to you. And that shouldn't be the cause for alienating members of a quote unquote tribe and further cementing, those people in that tribe. I think there's a difference and a marked difference between somebody like advocating for, you know, genocide or, against those particular rights and somebody, you know, just voting for the other candidate who maybe has a bad opinion on an issue.
I understand what you're all saying, and I mean, I obviously agree that first past the post is silly and doesn't make any damn sense. But I do want to call it here for a second that I understand the idea of not wanting to alienate people in this other tribe or whatever else, and to look at this and to say, oh, these are people who exist there and they have a lot of reasons for why they may do what they do, but it is very difficult for me to look someone in the eyes and say, have them say to me, yeah, I voted for this person that doesn't think that two groups that you're part of deserve to have these rights or whatever. And I don't think it's necessarily my job as someone who's impacted by those potential policies to walk over and say, well, here's my hand. Let's be friends.
No, like, I agree with that. Because there's this kind of like force, like, well, you have to get along with them. And it's like, no, that's also not a correct thing to tell people, because you're outsourcing. Like, let's say when party leaders, you know, tell people like, well, you need to get along with each other. Do we need to get along, or do you need to tell people to get along like that?
Yeah. Like, I feel weird when I'm, you know, if someone's talking about abortion rights and I'm over here, like there's a representative who's advocating against abortion rights. And I'm like, man, like, that has real ramifications in my life. Like, I could get pregnant and be forced to bear a child. That's horrific. That's terrifying, especially considering our healthcare system in the US. Like, very expensive. It's very taxing on my body. And so, you know, for someone to be like, oh, Gabby, like, just be friends with, and I'm like, absolutely. Or to understand them or whatever, it does strike a little bit of a nerve where I'm like, well, I get it. I do. I don't think everybody in every group is an awful, horrible, evil person because they voted this way. But it is hard for me to look at someone and say, this wasn't a deal breaker for you. You know, you weighed this out and you said, and that just to me is a judgment call, because I think all politics are personal. I think people who think that you can be political or you cannot, it's like, well, politics are just how we run our country and our society and the way that we function together in our society, making that like a commonality. So not to drone on about this, but back on social media so we can circle to our topic, but I do agree that tribalism can be really damaging and that there can be a black and white, and like what I said on the first episode, that you're not seeing a person, you're seeing an icon, and that I think contributes to that a lot. And if we could break that barrier down and have more gradients, and if we could shift our system so it wasn't a this or that, I think would be awesome and would help a lot of these problems.
No, I get what you're saying. That was a Midwestern no, not a I disagree with you no. but it, coming to that point, is like tribalism is brought up, and I think it's not deployed cynically. You know what I mean? That I think people are talking about that there is real vitriol in this discourse, right? But it's almost deployed in the sense of like we all used to get along, and I'm like, I'm sorry, who were those people that got along? Because I don't think that was true. And if it was, it's only certain people that seem to get along. You get what I'm saying? So we can't just deploy tribalism as a blanket solution. I think in terms of us having good faith discussions and having this forum where we're discussing this as friends, right? If we were to get really vitriolic, then yeah, that's a very real example of tribalism to me, and that should be frowned on. But it also goes to show that like, politics is about influence and power, and it is about, you know, what you believe is right and what you want to get done. And that is a part of politics that people should not try to shy away from or try to like say doesn't happen. You are going to have beliefs that, like abortion, right? It is controversial, but I like you, I believe that, you know, it is a woman's right to do what she wants with her body. And that means that, you know, the state has to protect that as a right, right? When we fight for that, we can't just also say that, like, this is something we could reason people across to, right? If we want to make that a legal right, we have to take the levers of power and act on them. We have to exercise influence to get people to on our side. So that's the real practical application of politics. It's not just that we get along and we have a civil discussion, although having a good discussion forum and having a better civic culture definitely aids in that. But it also is the fact that we have to, you know, very clearly get our heads out of the sand sometimes.
So, I think there are valid points from all of you there. I would want to point out though, and my question is going to be, well, okay. So a little context. So take like 10 seconds, hopefully. But everybody's viewing, for instance, the abortion issue from a rights perspective. One side is viewing it from the rights of the woman who, you know, if things were adverse, would force someone to bear a child, that might be a moral wrong if that's against their choice. The other side is viewing it from the view of right of life, right of the unborn who cannot advocate for themselves. And based on science or not, if all sides just said, well, I can't be friends with you because you're going against basic XYZ rights here, especially on that issue, well, how do we expect to, for the people that we can reason with and the people that we can persuade, how do we expect to do that if we're willing? I know it's not any of our jobs, but if we're not able to all sit at the table and say, listen, you're coming at it from this way, I'm coming at it this way, why do you think it the way you do? Why do I think the way I do? If anything is going to be effective, my belief is that it's that. It's persuasion, it's reason, it's friendly rapport mixed with, well, hey, I don't see it the same way, and here's why. And that understanding fosters changes in belief. I know, it may not even 30% effective, but it's better than the alternative, which is 0% effective, of alienating, putting somebody into another camp and saying, you're the other side.
But do you think that, I mean, I guess in my view, having that viewpoint that says to me or to another person that you don't have the right to that is already alienating, right? Like having that viewpoint to me already functions as an alienation tactic. Like I don't,
They're not viewing it the same way, though. They're viewing it from the rights of another. They're coming at it from a completely different principle. People are talking in.
Like, I understand that. I know that. Yeah. I just.
Okay.
It does. I just hesitate to put it on the shoulders of the person who may be getting a right taken away from them to make that case to another person who may view it in a different way and to kind of hold their hand and walk them through that concept. Like, I'm not saying every single person who is pro-life or pro-right or pro-choice pro-choice should decide screw everybody who's not, right? But I do think it kind of putting that weight on someone who already has this worry of like, oh, this is scary, and then putting that weight of like, explain this to others, it feels unfair. But
yeah, no, I agree.
That's my take on that.
No, I don't think you guys were like, you know, bringing up bad points on either way. I just think that, you know, there's a case to be made of when to have proper discourse, how the discourse, you know, should be structured on maybe a better civic culture. But I think, you know, to Gabby's point and your point as well, is like, sometimes you shouldn't expect people to participate in the discourse either. And I think that ties back to what we were talking about first time. And I think maybe if we end this social media topic here, maybe is that we've kind of been forced into being obligated to have a take to everything. And I think your opinions still matter and still have weight, even if you're not posting them. I think that's what, if I can end on that, is that you don't have to prove to me you have a well-reasoned take on social media to say that you're involved in this. You get what I'm saying? But I think expecting the discourse to happen on social media and expecting people to always participate in it, especially like in the case you brought up now, I think this is where it just gets fucking alienating for everyone, is you're expected to like fucking have this debate in good faith or just have it right there. Cause I mean, it's the whole sea lioning thing they brought up back in the day, right? Of just, I'm inviting you to debate. Why aren't you talking? And I think that's what it gets back to, is we need to improve the civic culture such that we can have a proper way to discuss and debate politics, and our approach to politics needs to be corrected. If I can end on anything, that's that. I know we're kind I don't want to shut anyone down, but I know we're kind of approaching the end of the time. So is there anything anyone wants to finish on or plug?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that that's an astute point, and I hope maybe to wrap it up under one, you know, umbrella. Like, I much prefer, you know, debating anybody here or discussing our viewpoints here as face-to-face as we can be in the pandemic, as opposed to being forced to have that discussion incessantly on social media. I think that's a very good point. I'd much rather discuss my views with my good friend Gabby than
random person A who's screaming at you on social media, when you don't even want to be having a discussion. Like, please leave me alone.
Yes, and I'll just, you know, I want to thank you guys for having me on. If there's one point, and this is kind of referencing, I was in the comment section of the YouTube video when this got posted last week, just random point that we discussed back then that I'll say is like my closing comments. Don't be afraid to shut off social media. You're not a bad person. You're not disengaged. You know, be aware of what's happening, but don't be afraid to shut it off. You don't always have to be the person fighting to change people's opinions or being that comment section warrior. Just self-care, fam. You know, be aware, be educated. You don't have to be that person who's constantly fighting, because fighting is stressful. So thank you so much for having me on, guys. I really appreciated it.
My pleasure. Gabby, anything you want to end on?
No, not really. Thanks for your wrap up was good.
Yeah.
I like all of you. This is good.
I agree.
Bye. Yeah.
All right. Just some housekeeping before we wrap this up then. Thanks to everyone who's followed us on social media, the thing we've been telling you to get off of.
Yes.
Of course, you know, we're now on more platforms than just YouTube. We've made it to Stitcher, Spotify, and the Apple iTunes Store. I've been told that if you give us a 5-star review on iTunes, it helps us with the algorithm. That being said, I'm not really trying to get famous. I just want to have a nice independent space where people can, you know, as normal people, talk about politics, society, and culture, because I feel like that's a space that's governed by people who have a mainstream elite opinion that I don't think is accurate. And I think, you know, having this forum as it is good. But if you want to throw us that support, I am not going to say no to it.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks again, listener. I'm going to try and fix some of the audio issues that came up. If they don't, I'm very sorry you had to hear me chewing. But stay safe, stay warm, be shooting, and by God, be tooting.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.